First today, the mystery of the oceans and the man who led the effort deep underwater to find the remains of Air France Flight 447 and map the wreckage of the Titanic. Dr. David Gallo is Director of Special Projects at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution in Massachusetts. He thinks we're taking the oceans for granted. He's in town tonight to speak at the Linda Hall Library, and he joins us right now. And David, so good to have you. Welcome to Kansas City.
Thanks, Steve. My pleasure.
Well, let's begin with this, David. We have the technology to easily find a lost iPhone in a huge city, but we still struggle to find vanished jumbo jets on the ocean floor. Why is that?
You know, I've done both of those things, and I found my iPhone a lot easier than finding a missing airliner. It's a big planet, and it's a very deep and dark ocean. Mm-hmm. And you know, average depth is about 2 miles, and most of it's unexplored. About 92% of the ocean's unexplored. So it's
92% is still unexplored.
Unexplored. And so when we look for something in the deep sea, it's like going to another planet.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, ships don't go very fast. There's not that many ships that can get way out there. There's not that many tools that can go that deep. So it's a difficult process. But it is amazing. And the lesson we learned from Air France 447, which we eventually did find,
yes,
was never let that happen again, that a plane goes without knowing exactly where it hit the water. And, you know, we did it again with Malaysian Air.
So we learned what from the Air France flight?
Well, that was thought to be unfindable. It landed in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean on the top of a very rugged mountain range, and people thought it's gone forever. We'll never find that plane. And it took us a bit to find it, but we found it. And the thing was, we tried to explain to people that, look, you can't lose a plane in the ocean. It's just not that easy. It's not like a land. It's a lot harder to find something at the bottom of the sea. So, and in this day and age, you need to know where planes are at all times. So when one does go into the sea, you don't have this giant haystack with a very tiny bits of a needle in it. You've got a tinier haystack to look in.
So you found Air France Flight 447. How then, David?
Yeah, it was. We had some advantages. First of all, it was a huge effort. We had the French governments, the Brazilian governments, and we had, you know, we had the families of the victims, that Brazilian, French, and others that were counting on us and had confidence in us. But with Air France 447, there were bodies and wreckage recovered, so we at least knew a plane had gone into the water someplace in that location.
That was on the surface.
That was on the surface. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now that was backtracked by modelers to the wrong place. They said 98%. Sure that the plane's in this part of the haystack that you have. And they were 100% wrong. The plane wasn't in that part of the haystack. So we spent 2 months in a way, I won't call it a wild goose chase, but it was the wrong place. So we went back the next year and just very methodically going back and forth, like plowing a field or mowing a lawn. And eventually, 7 days later, there it was. There was the plane.
And so, your involvement in that was to do what?
I was co-leader of the of that effort to find the plane. But, you know, it's one part of a big effort, international effort. But we do that at Woods Hole Oceanographic. We go to sea. We work in those mountain ranges. So there's no place too deep for us, no place too rugged. It's what we do normally as part of our science.
And what kind of pressure did you feel from the families to respond? What kind of pressure did you feel personally to come through for them?
Well, Steve, yeah, it was that pressure that made me go to the director of Woods Hole and say, we need to help here. And listening to some of the families and knowing that their loved ones were on that plane, there were children on that plane, there were parents, loved ones, associates, and just thinking about what they went through, that could be any of us, or it could be anybody. You know, we're not, no one's exempt from having that happen to them. And I actually put on my wall in my office, I had a picture of all of them, of each of them, of the victims, and that gave us the motivation to really push hard to get involved. It wasn't easy to get involved. You know, I remember going off to Paris with my little briefcase and my pictures from the Titanic saying we can do this, and it wasn't so easy to get the confidence of the French government or of the families, but eventually we did.
What was the moment in that particular instance when you realized you had found the plane, David? What was the moment, the eureka moment, if you will, if you can have a eureka moment in a moment like that?
Yeah, there was after the first 2 months, which was horrible, because we went 2 months out there saying we'd find the plane. We were in the wrong place to look, as I said before. And the pressure started building. You know, weeks went by, and then months went by, and we found nothing, not a bit of evidence. And then you start to, self-doubt creeps in. But one of the big moments was that the French, the BEA, that's their NTSB, said, we'll give you whatever you need, however much time you want, to find this airplane. So they gave us enough to do this whole haystack on the bottom of the ocean.
Enough meaning
money and time.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Instead of saying that we'll give you 2 more weeks, so we'll give you, they just said if you need 3 months, you got 3 months. And I wasn't in, there were going to be 3 months. I was going to go the second month, so I came back to Woods Hole. I left the ship in Brazil. The ship went out with Mike Purcell and team on board, my dear colleague. I came back to Woods Hole, and by the time I pulled into my driveway, I got a phone call from Mike saying that, well, we've been successful. I just about fell out of the car.
And what did he see that they knew for sure it was Air France Flight 447?
It was the skill of the operators of the sonar that picked out something on the seafloor that didn't look right. It was just a smudge, and a lot of people would have just let it go. But they were skilled enough, this guy named Andy Sherrill, who's involved with Malaysian Air, too. I'm very happy that he's out there. He was able to say there's something funny about that. And then we told the robot to send it back to take photos, and there was the landing gear and some of the engines of Air France 447.
I imagine the trick is the longer you go, the chances of finding, does it get more difficult because things can be covered up and moved and shifted and all this stuff?
It's not so much that, although that could happen. In the mountains, you can get, there's volcanic eruptions, there's lots of landslides, so you can get things covered up a bit. But in a year or two or three, it's not so bad. I mean, the sediment doesn't really, there's not that much out there, but a dusting maybe. But you do worry about things like any forensic evidence, bodies, or the black boxes, if the information is still in the black boxes. Yeah. So you are under that kind of time constraint. And then you worry about fatigue because there aren't that, as I said, you know, there's not that many teams that can go out there and work. And this one with Malaysian Air that's out there now, they've been out there months. That's day after day after day, 24/7, looking for this airplane. So after a while, you just fatigue starts to set in.
Well, I want to ask you about Malaysian Airlines Flight 370. You know, and just to wrap up, Air France Flight 447. Did we change anything in the wake of that to make these planes easier to find?
No, I don't believe so.
And why not?
Shame on us. You know, it's arrogance, and I just don't.
I can't imagine it'd be that tricky to do, or maybe I'm wrong.
Well, it comes down to money, and I do understand some airlines are getting better at it, but the latest thing I heard was that they're going to try to report their position every 15 minutes. Well, 15 minutes of flying is about 150 miles, and if you have a circle that's in diameter, that's 300 miles in diameter, that's a huge haystack, and that's months of search at sea, so that's not good enough. Mm-hmm. You know, so I don't quite understand what the issue is, and maybe after this last one, Malaysian Air, we'll learn our lesson and start tracking these
planes.
What
would solve the problem? Do you have a solution in your mind that a certain kind of box or pinger or something
that
would—
Yeah, stream the data. Why not? Stream the data. So
meaning every moment where the plane is?
Every minute, where is that plane? Is something going on? Why do we have to go out and recover these black boxes? It's like looking in the Rocky Mountain for a shoebox at night with a flashlight. You know, it's just not the way to do things. It's medieval in a way. So we need to have that information in real time if something's going on. If you look at on the web, FlightRadar24, that's the .com, it'll show you every plane that's flying, basically every large plane. It's mind-boggling how many thousands of planes are flying out there, most of them over the ocean. So it's just amazing to see that. I think we just need to realize that it's not always just about money. When people bring that up, I ask them to go look at and listen to some of the loved ones of the families of the victims. And what's that worth to you, that anguish of day after day not knowing what happened to your child?
Dr. David Gallo is with the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution in Massachusetts. He speaks tonight. He's the first featured speaker in the Linda Hall Library's To Boldly Go Spring Lecture Series. He speaks at 7. The event is free, but reservations are required. Go to lindahall.org for more information. So Air France Flight 447 crashed in 2009, David. Let's go back to Malaysian Air. We've referred to it a few times here, 370. This is the flight from Malaysia to Beijing that crashed about a year ago, 239 passengers aboard. The flight absolutely has appeared to have vanished.
Right.
We don't know where it is. Give us an update. What do we know about that plane?
Well, what we know, unlike Air France 447, where we found bits of the plane and bodies on the surface, there hasn't been a single shred of real evidence that a plane crashed into the ocean. So we're dealing with—
We even know if it was the ocean or on land?
There's not a bit of that plane that showed up anyplace. So when you think of how many, in the early days, I said, well, it's a big sea and it's easy to miss floating debris. But after this long, it's been a year, with so many ships in that area, so many planes searching, that you'd think something somewhere would have washed up. So That really doesn't help lend any confidence. But
what does it make you think?
I don't know. And that's part of the problem.
You know, it's a pure 100% mystery to you, then.
To me, it's 100% mystery, sure. Yeah. And it's going to be a tough one to solve. You know, the only thing we're going on right now is this thing called Inmarsat. It's a communications satellite that they've used some pings back and forth from the plane to deduce that it went south, and it's somewhere along this long ribbon in the Indian Ocean. So it's a long way away from any place off the west coast of Australia. So it's a mathematical construct that they're basing this whole thing on. And I know the Australian Transport Safety Bureau is pretty confident that it's down there someplace. But, you know, I've seen these things turn on a dime, that one little thing. Someone goes, oops, you know, we made a mistake with this or with that, and that may not be right anymore. So to me, it's a big mystery. And the only thing we know is that the plane headed toward Beijing, and then it turned left and disappeared. I mean, that's about all we know. All the rest of it's sort of deduced.
How unusual is this to go a year without any clues about the disappearance of an airplane that large?
Yeah, I think it's pretty unusual. I don't know any other case where it's been so long without any shred of evidence about where that plane and all those passengers might be. You know, it lends itself to a lot of conspiracy theories, too.
Mm-hmm.
It just doesn't help, and especially to the crews out at sea, because, again, if you're out there for months at a time, you start wondering, are we wasting our time?
Yeah. Well, you did a show for Nova a while ago, the title of which was Why Do Planes Vanish? So you have 30 seconds. Why do planes vanish,
usually it involves the ocean, you know, and the oceans are deep and dark and unexplored. So
what brings them out of the sky to begin with? I mean,
in the case of Air France 447, it was probably mostly pilot error. I think some people would argue that there was a little bit of the plane involved, but I think mostly pilot error. And it looks... This latest one, AirAsia, was about the same. It looks like they pulled back, stalled the plane. And, you know, the Airbuses fly by computer mostly, and if the computer gets confused, turns hands over control to the pilots, and if they don't react quickly and in the right way, they can get themselves in trouble pretty quickly. So it's, I think it's that combination of a little bit of the aircraft and
but
a lot
of... But people don't
that.
Think of these things as being all that dangerous, but you're saying
maybe
they're really
safe. I mean, if you look at air miles, you know, the way I look at it, and I'll be flying tomorrow and I flew out here, is that, and I think about this all the time, the way I think about it is that they're safe as long as you don't get into trouble. But when you do get into trouble, it's usually trouble.
Mm-hmm. And you get into trouble because...
Well, I mean, it can be an aircraft issue, a malfunction in the system, or it can be pilot error. So you've got one of the two. But again, you know, people say it's one of the safest modes of travel that there is.
You also led the project to map the Titanic when it was found. Was this after Robert Ballard discovered it?
It was. And I worked
He was on our show once. Just a fascinating guy.
Oh, he's amazing. And I went to, in fact, he's the one responsible, an article in National Geographic that got me into the oceans. And I worked with Bob. I was his assistant director for 5 years. Just an amazing explorer and intuitive sort of guy. I could never learn from him, because so much of it he was born with. You know, it's not stuff you can learn. You can watch it, you can appreciate it, but learn it, nah.
You were mapping the site. What does that mean exactly, David, to map the site?
Well, to me, most of the expeditions that have gone out there have been a bit touristy. So they go to the same places, the bow, the bridge, the grand staircase, the propellers. And the Titanic, when it broke in half on the surface, you've got two big pieces of the hull separated by 6 football fields, and in between hundreds of thousands of items, some belonging to the ship, others belonging to the passengers. And Titanic's 100 years old, plus 103, something like that. And we need to know, do we let the ocean take its course with Titanic and eventually just collapse on itself and all those artifacts will disappear? Or are there things that we should recover? And that's not a decision for the scientists to make, but we need to provide the information about what's actually out there. So we mapped an area that was about 3 miles by 5 miles, much larger than the debris field of Titanic.
With each, and you detailed where
every little thing. Yep, we've got photos, we've got sonar making maps with sound. So all the big pieces, the boilers, right down to the wine bottles and the shoes and things like that, and lights and china and all that stuff. So now someone can come along and at least know what's out there. Now next thing to do is to test the ship, do metallurgical studies to figure out, is it going to last for 100 years or 500 years or 1,000? And there's a reason for that. Every single year, 14 ships about the size of Titanic sink in the deep ocean. You don't hear about them because they're ore carriers or tankers. But on average, it's like that. It's like 14 big ships, and they vanish without a trace. And we're learning from Titanic, how do you work around ships like this? If you have to do a forensic study, how do you do it?
Hmm. Did you actually go down and take a look at it?
We used robots on the expedition I co-led. We used robots to do that because it was more precision mapping that we had to have than it was being there. The next trip I get to go, I gave away some of my early dives on Titanic to some people I thought deserved them, and I've been waiting a long time to get there and see face-to-face.
I'll never forget what Dr. Ballard told us the day he was here, this notion of when they first came across the wreckage for the first time, the clues that they were about to stumble across the Titanic in this vast, dark space were shoes on the ocean floor.
Sure.
And this notion that the tannin, I guess, in the leather of those shoes had preserved them enough that that's what they saw first. They knew they were getting close to something
Absolutely.
Because of shoes.
It's
what a haunting image that is.
It's haunting. And, you know, with the robots, instead of three people in a sub, you've got super high-definition cameras in a control room. So you have a whole team of people watching. So you've got this more or less larger audience watching what's going on the seafloor real time. And you see all this stuff, and you know that the Titanic's dead ahead. Then all of a sudden that hull just looms out of the darkness. I've got goosebumps now thinking about it. It's an amazing, amazing thing. There's a company called Premier Exhibitions they're the ones that have the touring and exhibits in Las Vegas and the like, and they've done an incredible job at preserving some of those things like the shoes and some of the newspapers.
It was here in town, yeah.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yes, and your point about that is?
Well, it's important to, I think, you know, initially we thought, well, we shouldn't touch anything there.
Yes, right.
And then when we went to visit the exhibit, we realized it's a very powerful way to tell that story. Mm-hmm. So if it's done well for the right reasons, it's powerful.
Hey, how did you learn how to track down sunken ocean liners or passenger planes so far below the ocean surface? How do you learn that? Where do you go to school for that?
It's all in the science, you know, because with the science we do, we want to take precision measurements. And instead of going willy-nilly all over the place, we do these very, very controlled grids, like the best mowed golf course or best plowed field. So, and we're used to working in the very deep ocean and mountain ranges. So it just fits into what we do, and there happens to be a shipwreck or a plane in the middle of that. So we go just to make a map of what's there, and there they are.
You know, people don't think of the ocean floor as a mountain range. They think of it as being just flat like a desert.
It's got the highest mountains by far. It's got the greatest mountain range, 50,000 miles long, by far on the planet. It's got valleys thousands wider and deeper than the Grand Canyon. Underwater lakes, I'll show pictures of a couple
underwater
times.
Lakes?
Yeah.
Meaning?
Underwater. You go to the bottom of the ocean, you come across the seafloor, and all of a sudden you're looking at waves and a shoreline with animals living on the shoreline. It's a lake at the bottom, super salty water. And it looks just like a lake up here at nighttime, lit up at nighttime. It's mind-boggling. Underwater
That's
rivers
incredible.
Go along with the lakes, and then underwater waterfalls as well. So mountains, rivers, valleys, lakes, waterfalls, all that stuff. It's not a big blue fishbowl. It's an amazing, amazing place.
Underwater waterfalls.
Yeah.
Help me with that.
Density. So if you have cold, salty water, it'll sink right to the bottom of the ocean. Fresh water will float. So depending on what the water's got in it, and that depends on evaporation and stuff, it'll be shallow and warm or cold and salty and deep. And in the Arctic, there's evaporation going on, so you end up with a lot of salty, cold, super cold water. When it moves south, it goes over one of these huge valleys, and the greatest waterfall on Earth is between Iceland and Greenland. It's like five times higher than Angel Falls. It's called the Denmark Straits. It's mind-boggling.
Dr. Witt, when it's so dark down there, how do you see those things and get a sense of their scale?
In that one, Denmark Straits, it's too big to see, so we can put instruments in it. We can calculate it. But we haven't been able to see it per se.
You have to imagine it.
You have to imagine it. Well, yeah, it's there for sure. We know the water's going there and coming out the bottom. In the smaller cases, I've been actually in them in the submarine, where you've been on the bottom and getting jumbled around wondering what's going on, and you realize that there's a waterfall above you that's where water's just pouring over some small cliff, which was disconcerting.
It's such a bizarre idea.
It is. For us, it was really bad. It's one of the few times I turned just, I think I lost all the blood in my system. I said, what in the world is that? I thought some giant squid had grabbed the submarine.
Do we know more about outer space or the oceans on this planet?
Oh, you know, I don't. I mean, outer space is fascinating. It's mind-boggling to me. Even the ability to go into space and look back at Earth is an amazing thing for us to be able to do.
Yeah.
And you'd think we would learn from that, because that's a privilege. I mean, that's an incredible thing to do. But we need to understand this planet, honestly. I mean, your weather here in Kansas comes from the ocean, comes from the Pacific Ocean, a little bit from the Gulf of California.
Help me with that, because we're out in the middle of, we're far away from the coast.
Sure,
here.
But the humidity, all that stuff, the water in the atmosphere, that comes from the Pacific. The weather pattern itself is set up thousands of miles away in the Pacific. The oceans, it's the air we breathe. Every other breath of fresh air you take, the oceans produce that oxygen, 50%. The food we eat, there's 2 billion plus people that depend on the oceans for food. And then the water we drink, almost all the rainfall patterns on Earth controlled by the oceans. And we haven't explored them, let alone understand them.
And you say we take them for granted.
Absolutely. I mean, I think we just think that it's the beach and, oh, I've been there. Or, you know, if you go to the middle of the Pacific Ocean, catch a fish, look at its stomach, you'll find micro bits of plastic. And if you look at the flesh, you'll find pharmaceuticals, flame retardants, herbicides, pesticides. And I think we had this idea that it was, you know, as they say, too big to fail, and it's not. So we need to change our relationship with the sea, because we need a healthy ocean to keep us healthy, humans healthy.
You know, you got this absolutely huge response to a TED Talk you gave. The talk was titled Underwater Astonishments. It was number 3 for years. And our listeners can Google and talk Google the talk and then watch it, Underwater Astonishments. It lasts just but a few minutes. Tell us about some of these creatures you talked about there, because they just absolutely fascinated me. There was this octopus that was so incredibly well camouflaged, you just took your breath away.
Yeah, the first time I saw that, that's the research of a buddy of mine, Roger Hanlon. And the first time I saw it, I thought he was pulling a Photoshop joke. Absolutely did not believe it. But the octopuses and some squid, some cuttlefish can not only change their camouflage in a heartbeat, but they can also change their texture, meaning they have got little muscles in their skin so they can be smooth, or they can be incredibly bizarre. They can look like algae on the bottom. And that particular one, it's hard to, it's a big octopus. It's about, 4 feet, something like that across.
Yeah.
And it just appears out of no place. And the audience always gasps when they see that thing appear. And it's hard to believe that it really.
Oh, it's incredible. Again, the title of the film, Underwater Astonishments, on the TED Talk. You just got to see it. And there's this male fish that would display themselves as one color on exactly half the left side of their bodies to attract a mate, and a different color on the other half to repel predators. Again, you could see it. You just couldn't believe it.
It's mind-boggling, because he has a woman, a female next to him, and he's careful enough that she only sees Mr. Nice Guy, and any males on the outside, he splits his body color, so they only see Mr. Aggressive. So, and when she moves over, he switches his body color, so she still only sees Mr. Nice Guy. It's amazing.
And then there are these animals that live so far beneath the surface, and the way they display themselves in the vast darkness out there, like neon lights blinking
like
on Broadway or something.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great way to put it. You know, it's almost a dreamlike state. There's that blanket of water. We talked a lot about the seafloor, but on the way to the bottom, we pass to 2.5 miles of water, and it takes about 2.5 hours to do that. But in that world, we thought there'd be no life at all. It's full of life, and most of those animals use bioluminescence. They're like fireflies, mm-hmm. and they use that to attract mates. They use that to attract prey, to avoid being eaten, and it's just an amazing show to look out the window of the sub into the darkness and watch that.
And David, just finally today, what can you tell us about global warming and the impact that's having on rising sea levels and all those good things? What should we know?
Yeah, here's the deal. You know, there's a lot of controversy, and I think we've made it that way, but things are changing. This planet has changed for 5 billion years. The face of the Earth changes constantly. Plate tectonics tells us that, and the climate's been changing constantly. We have had a contribution to that, humans have, but what we need to do is recognize that change is coming. We need to minimize our own impact, and we need to find out the changes, rhythms, and cycles. We just need to find out how the ocean is working and the planet's working, how is it changing, and work with it rather than against it. But I promise you, things are changing faster than we can understand what's making them
change. Is the ocean rising now?
Yeah, parts of it are definitely rising now. And it doesn't all have to rise. It's a very bizarre system, but in places, the oceans are rising faster than we ever expected.
Hmm.
Sure.
Again, Dr. David Gallo is with the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution in Massachusetts. He speaks tonight. He's the first featured speaker in the Linda Hall Libraries to Boldly Go Spring Lecture Series. It's at 7 o'clock. The event is free. You got to get a reservation, though. Go to lindahall.org for more information and to do that. And David, you're just terrific. I really appreciate the conversation. Thanks very much.
My pleasure.